Hello, my friends. Today's wrong question is this. Can we prevent the AI crisis? I've seen this question everywhere, in the comments of my videos, in headlines, and in think pieces and articles, and worried conversations at conferences. And people have very different ideas about what the crisis even means. Some think it's AI replacing workers entirely. Others think it's wealth concentrating till we're all living in techno-feudalism. Some think it's, well, even darker than that. We'll get there. But underneath, they're all asking the same question. Can we stop this? Here's what I need to tell you. Probably not. History suggests we don't prevent crises. And more importantly, we actually don't want to. But, and this is crucial, we can shorten their pain. In today's episode, I'm going to show you why prevention is actually the wrong goal. I'm going to introduce you to something I call the chaos window, and I'm going to explain how the work we're doing right now could save a generation of humans from decades of unnecessary suffering. This is the Hello Tomorrow podcast. Let's go. A few weeks ago, I released an episode called Who Buys Your Stuff, Robots? It wondered, if AI replaces workers and workers lose income, who buys the stuff the robots make? That episode is still growing on YouTube, currently with 200,000 views and over 5,000 comments. I do my best to read everything you post. In those comments, I think I've seen every version of the AI crisis people are wondering about. By the way, some of your arguments, really compelling. I had to go back and do more research just to keep up with y'all. You really do make this show better, so please keep sharing your thoughts. Now, the first category of solution to my question of who buys your stuff, robots, is basically B2B. Josh, business to business can replace business to consumer. Businesses will just sell to other businesses. Problem solved. Boom. Done. Now, this makes sense on the surface because B2B is big, like really big, almost twice the size of consumer spending in the overall economy. So I get why people think it could just replace B2C. But here's the thing. B2B is bigger because it feeds B2C. Here's what I mean. Steel companies sell to car manufacturers. Car manufacturers sell to you. If you can't buy cars, manufacturers don't need steel, right? So the challenge with this argument is that B2B isn't independent, it's derivative. Follow any B2B chain far enough, you hit consumers. That's where the value gets consumed. Now remember the loop. At some point, somebody has to buy the thing, to consume it, to want it. If that final consumer doesn't have income, the whole chain contracts backwards, right? B2B can't replace B2C because it depends on it. A B2B solution is really just pushing the same problem upstream, and eventually it ends up in the same place. So we can't solve the coming AI crisis with B2B. It's a great hypothesis though. The second category of solution is a little wilder. Something like, Josh, AI agents will just buy and sell and pay taxes and invest and do everything we do. The economy will just thrive without human participants. All right, let's dig into this one. These comments are describing a fully closed kind of machine economy, right, where AI agents are both producers and consumers. Value circulates internally. Humans just exit the loop. Now, that's not capitalism as we know it, of course, but more what we might call a synthetic economy. Honestly, it's not impossible. We could technically build that. So the question on this one isn't, can this happen, as much as it's, to what end? If AI agents are buying from other AI agents and investing in assets owned by other AI agents, paying taxes to governments that serve AI agents, value has become completely detached from the reason any of us care about money in the first place. In our world, money only means something because it represents other stuff, right? Status or access to scarce resources, control over labor, fulfillment of needs. But if the robot buyers don't actually need any of those things, the money transactions are just like bookkeeping. It's not really an economy. It's just like an accounting ledger, like talking to itself. The bigger question in this scenario is, why do we produce things at all? Well, we do that because humans want things. We compete for status and we buy things to try to find meaning and so on. But if machines are the only participants in the loop, what's driving production desire? At best, it's something like optimization. At worst, it's just inertia. Turns out there's a ton of sci-fi out there that explores the endpoints of this very idea. Some of you turned me on to things I'd never heard of before, and absolutely none of it is uplifting. We could design systems that exclude humans from economic participation, but why would we? This doesn't produce any kind of world that most of us actually want to live in. So that one isn't really a viable solution to the AI crisis either. The third category of solution is the darkest. It's something like, Josh, the rich don't need the economy to work for everyone. They already have all the resources. Fewer people means fewer problems, and they don't care about us anyway. I've seen this one paired with depopulation theories, billionaire bunkers, all of it. Look, I get why this resonates. Wealth is concentrating. Billionaires are buying remote islands and, yes, making bunkers. And it's not just Scrooge anymore. Some tech elites do talk about reducing surplus population.
But some would rather die.
If they'd rather die, then they'd better do it and decrease the surplus population.
Oh dear, oh dear.
It's not crazy to think maybe this is their plan. So let's take it seriously. If we go down this path, we end up in a place where we ask, what does a complex global civilization require to function? Because it's that complex adaptive system that allows the ultra wealthy to live their ultra lavish lifestyles. And when we answer the question of what a complex global civilization needs to function, the logic of this solution breaks down pretty quickly, because the ultra wealthy depend on systems that require a lot of other people. Think about what it takes to maintain a billionaire lifestyle. Private jets that require global supply chains for fuel and parts and pilots and air traffic control. Luxury goods that require designers and craftspeople and logistic networks. Medical care that requires doctors and researchers and pharmaceutical supply chains. Technology that requires engineers and chip fabs and rare earth mining and electricity grids. You couldn't run modern civilization with 100 people and robots. Feudal lords had all the land and weapons, but they couldn't maintain Roman-level complexity with tiny elite populations. Why? Because complex systems require large populations for specialization and redundancy and innovation. Without those things, the system simplifies. Less trade, less coordination, less resilience. Modern billionaires would face the same constraint. They might survive, but they wouldn't be able to maintain current levels of complexity. We're going to talk about this more next week. Complex systems need the conditions that sustain complexity. Remove billions of people, you don't get the same civilization. You get a simpler one. So I don't believe there's any kind of depopulation plan, but I do think there's a trajectory where capital optimizes for fewer workers, more wealth concentration, and further isolation of elites. Not because anyone's like planning it specifically, but because that's where the current incentives lead. It's not inevitable. It's just the currently incentivized trajectory. We talked about this last week. And here's the good news. Trajectories aren't destinations. Throughout history, the ultra wealthy forget that endless extraction ultimately devalues their own prestige. Their wealth only means something in the container of a functioning society. Money is a social technology. It requires collective belief. If society collapses, their billions are just numbers in a database that nobody gives a crap about. They need us more than they think, and we have more power than they seem to remember. So those are the main varieties of crises that people seem to be imagining. None of those possibilities quite hold up under scrutiny, but all of our collective intuition, I think, still seems to be screaming, there is a crisis coming, and AI will have something to do with it. I will admit, my spidey sense says the same thing. At a macro level, humanity has seen this pattern before, multiple times, across thousands of years, in every major civilization, I think. Our societies organize and then reorganize over and over. The word collapse often gets invoked in these situations, but to me, that word implies something that isn't exactly happening, which is why I like this notion of reorganization better. We've talked about this kind of transition before in relation to the fourth turning. There's a crisis and then a reorganization, a winter and then a spring. So when people ask, can we prevent an AI crisis? I can tell you what history suggests. Probably not. The reforms we desperately need, in this case, income replacement, automation dividends, public AI stakes, new social contracts. These kinds of things don't tend to happen before the disruption. They happen after. After the Triangle Fire, after the suffragists actually suffer, after the Great Depression, after the organizing conflict forces enough of us to choose. Now, I want to tell you a quick story about one major exception that happened in my lifetime. But, spoiler alert, I think this exception actually shows us exactly why preemption is unlikely to happen with AI. In 1987, the world did something remarkable. Scientists discovered that CFCs were destroying the ozone layer. Do you remember this? Some of you do. Hole in the atmosphere, massive skin cancer projections, and the world did something. 197 countries signed the Montreal Protocol. Collectively, we phased out 98% of ozone-killing chlorofluorocarbons. Today, the ozone layer is nearly recovered. This is a phenomenal example of global coordination and preempting a crisis. I actually remember this happening. I remember hearing about CFCs in elementary school and then watching hairsprays and aerosol cans of all kinds changing before my eyes on the store shelves, right? Single-digit-year-old me had no concept of how extraordinary that actually was. A double-digits-old me now wants to know, why were we able to do that? Why did it work? Okay, here's a few reasons. We had a visible threat, like a hole we could actually see in space photos. The science was undeniable. We had a clear mechanism, scary projections, no real controversy. Our institutions were trusted. The UN worked. Governments cooperated. People believed the science. Solutions existed and were actually profitable. Alternatives to CFCs were available, and the industry could adapt and even benefit. The problem was contained. Limited chemicals, specific industries, not the entire economy. But more than all of that, I think the when of this problem is what made all the difference in its solvability. This problem happened during the last cycle's high, between summer and fall. Right, this is the late 1980s. The societal weather was still good. Post-World War II institutional strength was still holding. Global cooperation was still possible. Compare that to where we are with AI and income displacement. The threat is abstract. You can't see unemployment from space. There's no hole to point at in a photo. The science is contested about AI capabilities, about economic impacts, social consequences, timelines. Everybody has a different prediction. Institutions are distrusted. Government approval ratings, historical lows, international cooperation, fragmented, conspiracy theories everywhere. Solutions are unclear, politically radioactive. UBI, automation taxes, public ownership of AI. I'm throwing some of these things out there, but every option kind of tends to touch a third rail. The problem is also foundational, not specific. This isn't limited to chemicals. It's the entire labor market. It's our social contract. It's how we organize our civilization. And to top it off, we are in winter. Like the late unraveling, the early crisis, not the high. Everything feels cold. Institutions are brittle, not strong. This isn't a moral failure. It's a structural one. We can't do Montreal Protocol style preemption when nobody trusts the scientists or the government or international bodies or each other, especially not when the problem itself is abstract and feels political and the solutions require completely reimagining how society works. That's why preemption worked then and why it probably won't work now. So, if we can't preempt the crisis, what is the point of me telling you all of this? Why do I make these episodes week after week? It's because of something that I call the chaos window. The chaos window is the period between when the old system breaks down and the new system takes hold. It's the messy, like melty transition from winter to spring. It's when society experiences maximum uncertainty and often maximum pain. But it's also the season that contains maximum possibility. And here's what history shows. Some chaos windows are short, and some are devastatingly long. But what makes them different isn't luck, it's preparation. And we're going to go into this in more depth in next week's episode. But for now, I'm going to summarize with a contrasting example from Chinese dynasties, okay? After the Han Dynasty collapsed in the year 220, China fragmented for 370 years before the Tang Dynasty reunified it. After the Tang collapsed in the year 907, it only took 50 years before the Song Dynasty pulled it back together. Same pattern, same civilization, but one chaos window was 7 times longer. What was the difference? After Tang, they had recent memory of unified governance. They had models, infrastructure, shared frameworks. They were prepared to rebuild. So they didn't spend centuries wandering. They spent 50 years. That's 320 years of suffering avoided. The actions of the leaders in the Song Dynasty didn't prevent the collapse. And in many ways, I don't think that's the goal anyway. The crisis is what allows for the change. Just like the decay of winter is what allows for the bloom of spring. We can't avoid winter, but we can help determine how long it lasts. The leaders of the Song Dynasty did shorten the chaos window. And that's why this work matters. Not because we're going to prevent the AI crisis, whatever it might look like, but because we're preloading the solutions. We're building vocabulary. We're circulating frameworks and planting ideas. So when our chaos window opens, when the old system visibly breaks and everyone's asking, what now? Some ideas are already there. Will they be perfect? No, but they will be ready to start testing. Is it noble to prevent suffering? Yes. Is it more noble to shorten the duration of suffering, even if you know you can't prevent it? Maybe, because every year we shorten the chaos window is a year of fewer families destroyed and fewer lives derailed and less generational trauma created and a faster recovery for our overall society. This isn't small work. It is not for the faint of heart. It is civilization level work, and it really freaking matters. We can do this, my friends. If you're still here in this community saying hello tomorrow with me, I'm guessing this might get you a little fired up too. So this week's Optimistic Rebellion is to look back in order to look forward. Think about the New Deal. It didn't appear from nowhere in 1933. Those ideas, progressive taxation, social insurance, labor protections, they've been circulating for decades. They've been simmering quietly, gradually, until ready for the suddenly. When the Great Depression hit, the frameworks were ready to deploy. That shortened the chaos window. Same principle here. Who buys your stuff, robots? It plants a question. The fourth turning framework gives us context. Economic systems thinking provides us with vocabulary. Every week, we are understanding the problems more and more clearly. And this allows us all to start brainstorming solutions now. And all of this will help us shorten our chaos window when it opens. So when someone asks, can we prevent an AI crisis? We know the answer is probably no, but we also know the exact future isn't inevitable. There are still so many choices to be made between here and there. Choices that will change the direction of the future we will actually get to experience. Next week, we're going to talk about the two most possible high-level scenarios I can currently envision about the future. But for today, our Optimistic Rebellion Challenge is to start a Hello Tomorrow Brain Trust. What does that mean? Find 3 to 5 people in your network with different expertise and perspectives. Set up a monthly conversation. Could be over coffee, could be over a video call, whatever. Just to talk about what comes next. Feel free to have everybody watch or listen to the weekly Hello Tomorrow episode and tear it apart if you like. You're not trying to solve everything. You're building community and preloading ideas. So when our chaos window opens, we're not starting from zero. FDR didn't invent his brain trust after the crash. He'd been developing it for years. And when the crisis hit, they were ready. More recently, Project 2025 did this too. Of course, I'm encouraging us to move into a better future and not into some kind of retconned past, but the same principle's there. We can do the same thing. Start the conversations now. Build the frameworks your community will need. I'm going to form my own brain trust too. We can do this together. Even if it's just a few people meeting once a month, remember, we're doing civilization level work. It's this work that will help us shorten our chaos window. Keep the faith, my friends. The future is coming. And together, we're going to make it a great, big, beautiful one. This has been the Hello Tomorrow podcast, where we cut through the noise, expose the systems shaping our future, and leave with more clarity about what comes next. If this idea gave you a better question to ask about the coming AI crisis, please share it with somebody you care about. And if you're thinking, I wish my organizational leaders were having conversations like this, that's exactly the work I do as a keynote speaker. You can find me at joshallan.com, joshallan.com. Thanks for being here. See you next week.